This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the run-up to the presidential election, Karl Rove, the president's chief political adviser, made it clear that he thought the turnout of evangelical voters would be the key to victory. A week later, it looks as if he may have been right. Evangelical Protestants voted in record numbers last Tuesday, and President Bush won nearly 80% of those 27 million votes. That's not the only explanation of why the Republicans won, and we know that the terms evangelical, conservative, or fundamentalist Christian describe a great many people with a wide variety of political opinions. But many religious leaders and activists say that the zealous grassroots organizations developed by white evangelical Protestants this year surprised Republicans as well as Democrats. So, what's the evangelical agenda now? Will votes translate into policy? Later in the program, we'll bring you an update on the fighting in Fallujah. But first, evangelicals in politics, we invite you to join the conversation, and we particularly want to hear from evangelicals. You helped give Republicans control of Congress and the White House. What do you hope for now? How do faith and politics mesh with separation of church and state? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Brian LaCroix, pastor at the Aberdeen Wesleyan Church in Aberdeen, South Dakota. And it's very good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation today.
It's my pleasure. I'm honored to be on your show.
I know that you spoke with your congregation about some of the issues at play in last week's election. Could anybody have left your church in much doubt of which way you thought might be the best way to vote?
Well, I don't believe so, but it's again, we're very careful that we understand the limits that a pastor has on what they can say from the pulpit, particularly not being allowed to endorse candidates. Mm-hmm. So generally what we've been doing is focusing on the issues as moral and biblical issues rather than political issues. The issues themselves are moral issues. They happen to be being played out in the political arena. And so I try to couch all of my comments regarding as to what does the Bible say about these issues, and then it's up to them to decide whether to take that and either agree with it and whether to take that into the ballot with them.
Is this something you have always done, or was there something this year that said, I've really got to change my mind and go about this a different way?
No, in fact, I hate talking about politics. I really do. And this year, I just felt that there were enough issues that were going to be decided or that were going to be affected by this year's elections that I felt I needed to speak out. And mainly, though, my efforts were to tell people that we have an abundantly exciting opportunity that that many countries don't have, and that is to be involved in the political process, in voting, and to make our voices heard. That's one of the things that makes this such a great nation. And that as citizens, I feel we have not only the privilege, but the obligation to vote and to vote for moral values.
And those issues were?
Well, probably the three main ones that came to my mind were abortion, that if we have a chance to enact pro-life legislation, that would be wonderful. Same-sex marriage was an issue. I make no bones about that. It's a heartbeat for me. I believe in traditional marriage. And also the issue of free speech that earlier this year, hate crimes legislation was introduced. It was defeated. That would make even parts of the Bible become hate speech, as has happened in Canada and in at least one European nation. And I felt that we needed to be able to say no. We should be able to have our freedom of speech. That is a constitutional right. And so those were probably the big three that prompted me to at least become vocal in encouraging people to vote and to vote moral values.
And now that the election is over, and as I'm sure you know, all kinds of analysts are saying, well, it was the evangelicals who made the biggest difference. What do you expect in return? Is there a quid pro quo?
Well, I've never felt that my vote was for sale. And I'm hoping that politicians' votes aren't for sale. I guess I am hoping that those we elected to office would remember why we voted for them and would indeed either introduce legislation or support legislation in support of those values that we believed they held as to why we voted for them.
And you say you hope they remember. Might you send them a reminder from time to time?
If legislation, if I am made aware of legislation upcoming, sure. And I did that with legislators in the past, that if I saw something was coming up and I wanted my senator or representative to vote a certain way, I would email them and or send them a letter or call their office saying I would like their support of this particular bill.
And obviously the situation in South Dakota, where you were involved, a very important Senate race as well. So if you called Mr. newly elected Senator Thune's office, would you expect somebody to answer your call?
I would expect someone to either answer or at least put me through to somebody who I could talk to. But normally I do it through email or through the mail, just because they're busy people and they can read my email quicker than they can visit with me over the phone in many cases.
On a couple of specific issues that you mentioned, on the gay marriage issue, I think Mr. Rove has already come out and said that he plans to hope that this would be reintroduced in Congress this year. Is that something that you would hope to see specific action on?
Yes, I do. But let me also quickly say that I have homosexual friends. My father-in-law is a homosexual, and I have lost friends to AIDS. So this is not just something that I think of on a political level. This has impacted me on a personal level. People I love are engaged in this lifestyle, and so I want people to understand that my desire and my hope is that the definition of marriage being between a man and a woman is not so much anti-gay as it is pro-traditional family. So yes, I would hope that that federal marriage amendment would be reintroduced.
And on abortion, thus far, over the past several years, the pro-life efforts have been focused on restricting abortion, the so-called partial birth abortion ban that was passed last year, parental consent, those sorts of things. Are those the kinds of measures that you would look forward to, or would you like to see Washington move straight ahead towards a more outright ban on abortion?
Well, I would love to see an outright ban. I just think that that's politically not going to happen, at least not in the near future. Regarding partial birth abortion, one of the issues that I look at in that is that the occurrence of that is hardly ever related to the health or well-being of the mother. And so that particular procedure I would like to see left alone. Parental consent is a real big issue with me. I have a teenage daughter, and it would bother me that she has to have my permission to get an aspirin in her school, but wouldn't need my permission to get an abortion. And so, yes, I do believe parental consent is a huge deal, and I'm a big supporter of that.
We're speaking with Pastor Brian LaCroix in Aberdeen, South Dakota. If you'd like to join the conversation about evangelicals and their political agenda now, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And Bob joins us on the line from Reno, Nevada.
Hi, Pastor?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a Bible-reading Christian, and I read in Matthew the parable of the wheat and the weeds, and I'm afraid you're putting a political test on salvation, and I'm worried about a lot of churches doing that.
Sure.
You don't have the right political ideas that you can't be saved, and that's not what the gospel says. It says it's by grace. It's the grace of our Lord that saves us, and that's open to everyone, no matter what their political beliefs.
I agree.
I'm really offended by the fact that the churches are trying, by innuendo, to suggest that people who vote the wrong way are not going to receive God's grace.
Let's get a response, Bob.
Okay. Oh, sure. I've got no, and let me say that I agree with you 100% that salvation has absolutely nothing to do with one's political beliefs or political thing. What I'm saying is that the issues that we're bringing up, for instance, abortion and gay marriage and all these things, that my stance, the stance of the evangelical Christian, is more in line with overall biblical principle and sometimes direct biblical teaching. I do not believe that a person cannot be a Christian and believe in pro-choice. I believe a person can be a Christian and be pro-choice. I don't understand it. I don't understand how a person could have those political views and say they love God. Now, that's not to say they cannot. I'm just saying from my personal perspective, I find it hard. I also want to be very clear to say that, again, God's salvation is not dependent on one's political view. But also let me just summarize that to say that these are moral issues that are played out in the political arena. They are not merely political issues. if we were talking about things just like tax cuts or highway projects, I wouldn't waste my time. But moral issues must be addressed, even if it's in the political arena.
Bob, I suspect you will not agree, but I think we just have to leave it there and move on.
Hey, thank you, Neil.
Appreciate the phone call, Bob.
Thank you.
Sure. And Pastor LaCroix, we thank you for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian LaCroix, pastor at the Aberdeen Wesleyan Church in South Dakota, with us by phone from his office in South Dakota and joining us here in Studio 3A to talk a little bit about who makes up the evangelical community and how this group might be changing is Mark Rozelle, a professor of public policy at George Mason University, the author of several books on the religious right. He's, as I said, here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
How important was the evangelical vote this week ago today?
Well, I think the evangelical vote was hugely important in this election. I know there's a lot of controversy about the extent to which this voting bloc was critical to Bush's victory, but if we look at the white evangelical and born-again population, that's about 22% of voters, and they went 78% for George Bush in this election, whereas that group, which was a significantly smaller percentage of the overall voting population in year 2000, went 72% for George Bush. So there was a substantial increase in voter participation by the core constituency that we call the religious right, and it also came out much more strongly for George Bush even than it did in year 2000.
And if we look at the closeness of the elections, particularly in places like Ohio,
right.
This turned out to be a big deal, particularly in those states where the gay marriage amendments were on the ballot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In Ohio, of course, there was the gay marriage amendment, and just looking at some of the data here, 62% were opposed to that amendment to legalize gay marriage. 86% among evangelicals supported that position. So that was clear in a way. But I should also point out that this was also a broad coalition for George Bush in this election. It wasn't just white evangelicals and born-again Christians mm-hmm. who delivered this election to George Bush. He did better significantly among Catholic voters. He did better among Jewish voters, among black voters. You could look at a number of different groups in the electorate and come to pretty much the same conclusion that George Bush did a good deal better than he did in year 2000, and that had a lot to do with his election victory this time.
And as long as we're talking about terminology, why don't we tell us a little bit more about what defines an evangelical?
Well, it's based on religious belief, and the pollsters used, unfortunately, sometimes they're not consistent, certain questions on the exit polls in order to decipher who are either quote-unquote religious right-identifying voters or who define themselves as evangelical or born-again Christians. So one of the difficulties we have right now is that there is somewhat a lack of comparability between the question that was asked in the 2000 election mm-hmm. exit polls and the 2004, whereas in 2000 the question was whether people are members of, consider themselves a part of the religious right movement. And the exit polls this time were asking whether people identified as white evangelical, born-again, conservative Christians. So they're not always synonymous with each other, but they're still pretty close.
Quickly, as an evangelical voter, writes Edward Bryan in St. Louis, I have to admit the things I want cannot come from the government. One of the things the mainstream press media must understand is that many conservative Christians believe the government should ideally play a limited role in society. Generally, we feel the institution of government, mainly the federal government, has become too large with too much influence over the lives of citizens.
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty widely felt view among many in the conservative evangelical community. Remember when President Bush initiated the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives in 2001. There was a lot of opposition among religious right leaders to the government getting involved in directly providing funding to religious-based organizations and church-based organizations, because many were concerned that this would mean that government would be imposing certain expectations or standards on the activities of churches and church-based groups.
Mark Rozelle, stay with us. When we come back from a short break, we'll be speaking with Rick Warren. He's the author of The Purpose-Driven Life and pastor of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California. And we'll also be talking more about evangelicals and their political agenda. 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing evangelical Christians and their role in the political world. If you're an evangelical, what do you expect from your political leaders, especially now after this past election? And are faith and politics inseparable? Join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Mark Rozelle, professor of public policy at George Mason University. And joining us now is Rick Warren, pastor of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, the author of The Purpose-Driven Life. He's with us by phone from California. Very good of you to take time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be with you.
As someone who has one of the more prominent voices in the evangelical community, is there something specific that you were hoping to get out of this year's elections? And if so, what is it?
Well, I've been waiting for the dust to settle on this before I spoke up because I wanted to see how the media was all going to explain the election. And I think that they are missing a big point here. In the first place, there's no single culture in America. We're multicultural, and that's why there are value differences. And this election was a cultural election. It was not a political election between Democrats and Republicans. Instead, it was really a debate between one coalition of subcultures and another coalition of subcultures. And it was not an election of the religious right or even evangelicals, which the media, by the way, don't understand the difference between.
Mm-hmm.
Same group. The nearly 60 million people who voted for Bush this time were part of a much bigger coalition. And really, when I look at it, one of the things is there's no such thing, in my opinion, as blue and red states. It's actually more about blue and red counties. Even here in California, where I live, California, New York, Oregon were mostly red counties, and Bush won about 2,500 of them, and Kerry won about 500. And the cultural differences are not primarily between evangelicals or even the religious right and the rest. It's primarily between, in my opinion, between the large urban cities and the rest of America. You know, Manhattan went for Kerry 85%. Hollywood probably did the same. They're in a bubble. They're not in the same groove as so many of the other subcultures. What surprised the media was that they don't realize, the media doesn't realize it's a subculture in itself. And I think that's what shocked them because they think they are the culture, and they were shocked by the election.
Well, then speaking for the coalition of subcultures which you represent, what's on the agenda? What do you want to see movement on?
You know, I think primarily is respect. I think primarily wanting a place at the table, because for years now, I think religious people who are in the majority in America, and I'm talking about not just evangelicals, of course, Catholics and evangelicals, I think this year realize they've got a lot more in common than they have in differences, and they join together. And those two subcultures, Catholics and evangelicals, make up 49% of the voting population. That's pretty big, and that's just two of the subcultures. But I think religious people for years have had their faith and values just made fun of and attacked in the name of tolerance. I think when they voted, the folks who pretend to be tolerant threw a temper tantrum. And, you know, you've been reading all these articles, press calling us ignorant, and it appears they believe in democracy as long as Christians aren't at the table. And I think the bottom line is that Bush got 61% of all faiths. All faiths. That's not just Christian. Bush got 61% of all faiths who attend weekly. Now, that's not fundamentalist fostering division, like Friedman said. These are people who said, you know what, we're tired of having our core values mocked, held in contempt, having us dismissed as flyover country, called ignoramuses, and that kind of stuff. I think they just say we have as much a right to be a part of democracy as some of the other louder groups, which are actually smaller.
And again, what issues do you want, now that you've got a seat at the table, I presume you do, what are you going to do with it?
Well, I think there are two sets of values that are important. And historically, you can't just say one set of values. There are social values which have to do with justice, equality, poverty, things like that. And then there are personal morality issues that have to deal with things like the definition of marriage. Mm-hmm. Is it between a man and a woman or between two men? When does life begin? The rampant vulgarization of our society on television, things like that. And typically, liberals have championed the social values, justice, equality, poverty, things like that. And the conservatives have championed the moral, the personal moral values, which have to do more with family and personal morality. I honestly think that the coalition is interested in both of those. I really do. I think they're interested in both. In our church, for instance, we are this last week, we in the last 40 days, we've spent over $2 million feeding 35,000 homeless in Orange County, every homeless person in Orange County, three meals a day for 40 days. Now, that doesn't conflict at all with the fact that we are opposed to abortion on demand, that we would say that marriage is between a man and a woman throughout history. And I think the main thing is they just don't, we think that government, democracy works pretty well, that if everybody gets a chance to have their say, we'll work it out. We just don't want activist judges determining our values for us.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. And Jessica joins us from Ortonville, Minnesota.
Hi, I love the show.
Thank you.
My main concern, especially after this election, has been the way the media has wanted to really divide up all these little groups and say, well, because this certain view is backed by the Christians, then therefore, you know, we can't adopt it because, you know, we got to keep the separation between church and state. And I would consider myself an evangelical Christian. I didn't vote for Bush. I voted for the Christian Freedom Party. And I just want to say that, in my opinion, everybody's worshiping something, and whether you're atheist or, you know, Muslim or whatever, and I don't think that just because you're a Christian means that you can't be involved politically, or like Garrison Keillor says, he wants to take all the evangelical Christian votes away because, you know, they're really from the heavenly kingdom, not from the United States or something. And I just find it offensive, especially with the press harping on this time after time, because, you know, these are values and mores that people held for thousands of years from every culture and religion.
Yeah. Mark Rozelle, yeah. Let me bring you back into the conversation.
Sure.
Jessica certainly talking about it, and also Rick Warren is a sense of resentment, tired of being mocked.
Well, that's been a long-standing feeling among religious conservatives in America ever since the religious right movement became mobilized beginning around the 1970s and became very, very active in American politics in the 80s and 90s and up to today. Always a sense that the mainstream media, mainstream institutions are aligned against them, that the rich and powerful, in a sense. I've been studying this subject for a number of years. I've talked to many reporters. I find that most who follow and study this and most who analyze this in the media and within mainstream institutions really sincerely want to try to understand different political movements, and they're not judging so much as they're just simply trying to provide, in this case, I would say, a straightforward analysis about what were the critical factors that affected this election and what the implications are going to be for this next administration. Now, you were asking the question repeatedly, what's the agenda? What specific public policy issues do you care about and are going to make a difference in the next administration? And I think that's really the important question right now. If George Bush does, to some extent, owe his election and reelection to the very strong support of religious right voters, and because he is a very strongly religious person himself, and he feels sympathetic with the movement and with many of its views, how is that going to affect policy over the next 4 years? How is policy now going to differ from the first Bush administration now that, for example, George Bush does not have the limitation of having to run for reelection? He is free to promote his agenda as he pleases with, as he calls it, a popular mandate, and also with strong partisan majorities in both houses of Congress, which are pretty strongly conservative right now.
Mm-hmm. Rick Warren?
Yes.
I wondered if you had a response to that.
Well, I do. You know, again, he used the phrase religious right. I just would say again, Bush got 61% of all faiths. It's not a religious right issue. He got 61% of all faiths who attend weekly. You know, the three biggest surprises of 2004 were, number one, the popularity of The Passion, the movie, which was spread word of mouth through a network of churches, Catholic, Protestants, and all different kinds. Second was...
Mainstream media played a minor role in that, too, but go ahead.
Well, primarily it was word of mouth through these networks. And then the second was my book. The media certainly hasn't promoted my book. It's selling a million copies a month. Publishers Weekly now announced it as the fastest-selling hardback, best-selling hardback in history. It sold 20 million copies in the last 2 years. Now, that's more than Da Vinci Code, Hillary's book, Bill Clinton's book, South Beach Diet, and Harry Potter put together. And yet you don't see that in the media, but it was through a network of churches, still selling a million copies a month. And that was a surprise. And then the third was this election. And all three of these point out that there is a conversation going on in America that most people in the media do not get. When you talk about gay marriage, when you talk about the vulgarization of our society, you talk about raunchy entertainment on TV, these are far bigger than right-wing issues. Most Americans oppose them. Most Americans, the vast majority. And I think the big surprise is the size of the electorate. The common conclusion was if you suppress the vote, then the conservatives win. Well, that's not true at all. The fact is 87% of people consider themselves to be religious.
Yet,
in America.
I don't mean to interrupt, but a lot of people say that, you know, many of those issues that you're talking about, the vulgarization of television and other mass media, Janet Jackson and dirty words on rap CDs, those sorts of things, those you really can't do anything about because they're part of mainstream culture. The courts protect it as free speech. Politics, you can do something about by going into the booth and pulling a lever or whatever it is you do.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. But what I want to point out on this is, who did Senator Kerry identify himself with? He held big parties with Whoopi Goldberg and other, Chevy Chase and others who just use vulgar language, made fun, and he identified himself with the Hollywood crowd, which is really out of touch with a lot of people of faith. Now, here's an interesting thing, and I've never heard a single correspondent, commentator in America ever point it out. In the past eight elections, since Carter was elected in 1976, America has always elected a president who admitted to being born again spiritually. Every single one of them, all eight, with a personal faith and relationship to Christ. It didn't matter if they were Republican or Democrat. It was Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush. All eight of them claimed to be, quote, born again. Now, why is that the big pink elephant in the room that nobody is pointing out that there is a number of people who, in their opinion, faith trumps everything else, and they're going to vote for that kind of person?
Well, let's get another caller on the line. This is Jeremiah, who's in Salt Lake City.
Hi.
I
have a quick statement and a quick question. My statement is that I believe that you can ban gay marriage, but you don't stop. You don't make a gay person straight by doing that, and that you can ban abortions, but you don't stop abortions from taking place. You just drive them underground. And so my question is, I'd like to know if your guests feel like legislating this personal morality actually has any effect, or if it just drives it further underground.
Let me speak to that, because first, I believe the guy's right on track here. And I think a lot of people are more interested in preventing the legislation of immorality than the legislation of morality. For instance, the gay marriage issue. I have gay friends. I was at dinner at a couple of gay friends' house 2 weeks ago. But the issue here is, are you going to force a redefinition of marriage? That's a whole different issue. That was not a battle that Christians asked for. It was forced on the table, and in a democracy, a bunch of people said, no, we don't want that. Now, that's their right. That's not intolerance. It seems like to me that tolerance is okay unless Christians vote, and then in that case, we don't want democracy.
Jeremiah, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Rick Warren, I know we've already gone past the time we promised that we would let you go. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Rick Warren is the pastor of the Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, author of The Purpose-Driven Life, and he was with us by phone from California. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mark Rozelle is still with us from George Mason University. And joining us now is Richard Cizik, Vice President for Governmental Affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals. He joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask you, again, we keep trying to get the issues that are on the evangelical agenda, if there is one, if there can be said to be such a thing. I think we heard definitely gay marriage and abortion. Beyond that, what else is on the agenda?
Well, this is the typical idea that we just have a couple of issues, you know, gay marriage, abortion, prayer in schools, as if anybody really believes in that idea today. Not even evangelicals want that on the agenda. We want the public acknowledgement of God. Yes, we want to support the faith-based initiative. But to answer your question, you know, we have a broad agenda, and it was described in a document that NAE passed, that is the National Association of Evangelicals, adopted in October. And it ranges from religious freedom for faith-based
institutions. This past October or
yes,
a year ago?
Yes, this October, okay. October 7. We adopted a document called an evangelical called a civic responsibility. And it addresses all of the issues from religious freedom, lo and behold, all the way to creation care for the environment. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. So, look, this stereotyping of evangelicals as a narrow, short litmus test that includes gay marriage and abortion, frankly, is a stereotype. And some of us resent it. It's a stereotype that we resent.
Does it not include gay marriage?
Of course
abortion?
It does, and I think there's a common consensus. You've heard that from Pastor Brian. You heard it from Rick. Yes, absolutely on those issues. But do we care about a broader array of concerns, a deep passion for the poor, as Rick communicated for the church, a love for the creation? Yes. A desire for racial justice? Absolutely. Commitment to peacemaking and global human rights? The evangelicals have led the global human rights movement over the last decade, with the passage of six major landmark bills that range from the Sudan Peace Act to the International Religious Freedom Act to the Trafficking Victims Protection Act to the North Korea Human Rights Act. I mean, these are landmark bills that evangelicals have led on human rights. Mm-hmm. So the stereotype, I'm sorry, is dead.
And on the environment, is this an issue, and as well as some of these others, where you see yourself not necessarily as in the one party or another, but working for a cause?
Well, I do. The NAE hasn't done more than to say in this past summer at a conference, we're going to develop a consensus, even within our broad movement of 50 evangelicals, about the subject of global warming. Develop a consensus, and then I think if we do, you'll find most evangelicals will make the difference in the passage in the coming 109th Congress on the Climate Stewardship Act that's sponsored by McCain and Lieberman. Now, have evangelicals adopted this cause en masse? No. But are we on the verge of adopting it as an issue of concern? Absolutely.
Stay with us, please. And when we come back, we'll take more of your comments and also talk more with Mark Rozelle at George Mason University and take more of your calls as well. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. After the break, we'll also go to Iraq and get an update on the situation in Fallujah. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a moment, we'll get to the update on the situation in Fallujah. But right now, let's continue our conversation on the role of evangelicals in politics today. Our guests are Mark Rozelle, Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University, and Rick Cizik. Excuse me for getting the pronunciation of your name incorrect earlier on. Richard Cizik is Vice President of Governmental Affairs at the National Association of Evangelicals. They're both with us here in Studio 3A. Let's get another listener involved in the conversation. Sarah's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, I'm an evangelical Christian, and I did not vote for Bush in this election. And although I am pretty much in agreement on the few issues that are being labeled as moral issues with most other evangelicals, I think the alliance that I see between evangelicals and the Republican Party goes well beyond those, and I really, really question that. And a good example is that when Bush made the choice to go to war in Iraq, I and many of my Christian friends were very disturbed by the way he went about that, with what I saw as real disregard for the international community. And I had friends who went to their church, and the pastor spoke from the pulpit and said, anyone who's going to go out and protest this war is committing an apostasy before God. And, you know, as if suddenly to be an evangelical means not only you're a Republican, but you're squarely behind war in Iraq. And I see that attitude, and I've seen it in the churches that I've been in for years, not just in this election, but for quite some time. And it's interesting that your guest brought up the environment, because for me, if we have a concern as evangelicals about the environment, well, Kerry was a much more promising candidate as far as that's concerned than Bush. So I just really question and am disturbed by the fact that so many of the people in my own tradition have sold out and gone not just on these key moral issues, but across the board with Bush and with Republican policies, and many of which I don't find represent me, don't represent Christianity, or don't represent the purposes of God. And so I really question that among my fellow evangelicals.
Richard Isaac, did you want to respond?
Well, I think the woman has a good point. Many of these same religious values voters, they don't like the war in Iraq. They don't like partisanship either. And yet, for whatever hesitations they had about Bush, they had a sense that a vote for Kerry would be a vote for a weakening of other moral values that they hold so dear, what Rick Warren called the personal morality values versus the social values. And, Kerry was a vote for a cultural stranger, and they weren't about to do that as evangelicals, no matter how Kerry stood for some values, in this woman's case on the environment, and frankly in my own case. I'm pro-environmental, but I'm also pro-business. So there's a tension here that evangelicals have. And the real power in the future, you see, is going to be those, not in politics, because religion leads politics, not the reverse, is those who will have the power are those who shape the moral vision of the religious communities of America. They have a great power, and it's a gift, and it must be used responsibly.
Sarah, thank you for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Do you see any possibility at this point of outreach? We do have a two-party system in this country, and churches, so far as we know, are not running slates of candidates, and I'm not sure how the Supreme Court would rule on that. But at the moment, it's within the two parties, and they do have very different visions, as you spoke about. At this point, can you see evangelicals in large numbers? And again, the vote went for President Bush amongst evangelicals about 8-2, 80%, working closely with the Democratic Party, if the Democratic Party does not change some fundamental positions.
Well, we're coalition builders. We've learned that as evangelicals on the Sedan Peace Act to collaborate with the Congressional Black Caucus to pass the bill, with gays to pass a global AIDS initiative. You see, that's the idea, bipartisanship, cross the aisle, cross the religious barriers, whatever, to pass bills. We have to be that way if we're going to win here in Washington.
Okay, let's get another caller in, and this is Nick. Nick's calling from Sioux Center, Iowa.
Yeah, I have a PhD in political philosophy, self-identified evangelical. I'm the chair of the Sioux County Republican Party. If you look at the CNN map, we're the reddest county in the whole state by a couple orders of magnitude, and we're only a population of 32,000 or so. I just wanted to comment a couple things. One is that I'm about 40 years old, never seen the kind of turnout in terms of volunteers that just poured in. Usually county organizations have to work to try to get people to come out. But and this time, we just had volunteers knocking the doors off, saying, what can I do? How can I help? Can I make phone calls?
Why was it different, do you think, Nick?
There are a couple things. One, I think, goes to the resentment issue that there are people that are just tired of being called dumb and easily influenced. I think was one of the words in the Washington Post a few years ago, and they want to say, look, we hate that. But more profoundly, and I think far more profound in this particular community, is the belief that we're a bunch of Dutch Calvinists up here. And we go back to a guy named Abraham Kuyper, and he said that every square inch is claimed by God, that there's not a single area of human life that God doesn't call us to witness in and to bear fruit in. And so we have a long-standing tradition of engagement in the culture. And it comes really out of that Calvinist faith, that evangelical belief that you have to give your heart to God, and then He calls you specially into all particular areas of life. Interesting thing: we have the perhaps the first biotechnological arrangement with a Christian college, decidedly evangelical and Christian up in Sioux Center here, and it's a profound awareness amongst I think, a growing awareness amongst all Christians, especially evangelicals, of their responsibility to the world. It takes very seriously John 3:16, for God so loved the world. And I think that belief really comes in tension with other ways of expressing the Christian faith that may be otherworldly.
I'm going to ask all three of you very briefly, and Nick, you're just as qualified to weigh in on this as any of the guests we have here in the studio. Where does it go from here? Nick, why don't you start?
Where does it go from here? I think it certainly goes to what the gentleman from the NAE was talking about, that evangelicals cannot be seen to be the sole property of the Republican Party. However, it does mean that evangelicals like myself, I grew up and was raised in a Democratic household, there was no place for me in the party. And indeed, it seems to me that after almost every election cycle, the Democrats made their firing line in the form of a circle and put all us pro-lifers in the middle.
I see. All right, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're running short on time. I did want to give Richard Cizik a chance to weigh in.
Well, Democrats have a lot of soul-searching to do, and we're reaching out to them as evangelicals saying, look, come meet with us. And we, as groups, met here in Washington on the 4th of November and said, meet with us. We're going to invite the majority-minority leaders and others to do that. But as long as abortion rights and gay rights activists set the agenda of the party, the Democratic Party will keep losing.
And if that's the situation, if the Democratic Party does not change on those issues, Mark Rozelle is the evangelical Christian right, however you want to define it, going to be considered a part of the Republican base?
I think as long as the Democratic Party is perceived as on the cultural and political left, the religious right movement is going to be strongly embedded in the Republican Party, and indeed was more strongly embedded in the Republican Party in this election cycle than ever before, and the data clearly show that. And I think the Democrats do need to do some soul searching indeed, because who has won the White House for the Democrats in my lifetime? Southern Baptists. Candidates who can appeal to white evangelicals in the South, pro-military voters, gun rights owners, and so forth. I mean, there's a huge cultural divide now that's reflected in a lot of the studies about this particular election. And I think the Democrats really have to look at their nominating process, how it is possible for the party to get candidates who can build a broader base coalition of support and try to break through this cultural divide that really hurt the party in a big way. I mean, I said after this election, the Democratic line should be, it's the culture stupid, not it's the economy stupid. They have to really look at this carefully.
Nick, thanks very much for the phone call, and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. I'd like to thank Mark Rozelle for being with us. Mark Rozelle, professor of public policy at George Mason University, and also Richard Cizik, vice president of governmental affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals. Both were kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.